Welcome to Culturetopia, your weekly dose of culture love from National Public Radio. I am Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Bob Mondello, movie critic for NPR on All Things Considered.
You can always subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
an interview with John Hillcoate, director of the film adaptation of Cormac McCarthy's The Road.
DJ Spooky journeys to Antarctica to record its AC soundscapes.
And Danielle Wanadine talks about his new book of short stories that give the backstory on Pakistan. But first,
there's a new princess in town, and her name is Tiana. Disney's latest heroine meets cute with an amphibian in the animated feature The Princess and the Frog. The movie is set in 1920s New Orleans, where a visiting prince is turned green and hoppy. But he knows the fairy tale cure for his condition, so he shows up at a Mardi Gras ball, hoping a kiss from a princess will make him human again. The strong-willed young lady is Disney's first African-American princess. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates says a lot of black parents and their children are greeting Tiana with high hopes and open wallets.
They've been waiting at the Westfield Culver City Mall for hours now. Mothers and daughters and even some dads, all eager for the double glass doors of the new Disney store to officially open. Denise Ross and her daughter Alana waited 3 hours for the store to open.
I'm just excited. I'm even having my own Tiana Princess party. Yes, we are.
And we're going to go see the movie.
And I'm taking a group of kids to the movie to see the movie after the party.
In fact, Tiana fever is much more apparent among black parents, especially mothers, than their daughters. There's a deep emotional satisfaction in finally having someone who looks like them as a lead Disney character. Ron Edwards came with his 4-year-old, Morgan. He thinks it's important to buy Tiana merchandise to send a message to the Disney company.
Especially because it's one of the first characters, you know, African-American characters that Disney has really given a whole, you know, marketing campaign to. So it's good for little girls such as mine to see themselves in, you know, a positive light.
Sidra McLaurin agrees but has one reservation.
I'm disappointed that the prince is not African-American.
The interracial romance between Tiana and Prince Naveen has been controversial. Many black women worried aloud, on the internet and in the press, that pairing Tiana with a non-black prince sends a discouraging message about the possibility of black couples finding their own happily ever after. But that concern aside, black consumers have invested in Tiana with a joyful ferocity that's making cash registers ring like crazy.
We're selling out of individual items, particularly the dolls and the role play. The dresses are doing incredibly well. And this is before the movie's even come out. People are loving this product before the movie comes out.
At Disney's corporate headquarters in Burbank, Mary Beach, vice president of franchise development, is giving a tour of the Tiana-palooza of merchandise that's being released.
We have symbols, the Ray maraca here, which I love.
Ray is a lightning bug, the movie's Cajun Jiminy Cricket. Bath products were contracted out to a black beauty company, Carol's Daughter.
Sometimes the beauty products come later. They want to wait to DVD or wait till another time to make sure the film hits.
Beach says this company wanted in right away. Disney hasn't always felt such love from black consumers. Many baby boomers remember their parents' angst at movies such as Song of the South. Then there were the crows in Dumbo.
But I'll be done seeing about everything when I see an elephant fly.
What you say, boy?
I said when I see an elephant fly.
Those lazy, no-count crows made black parents cringe. This is different. Back at the mall, even Disney staff are amazed at the turnout, which stretches the length of the complex. Awestruck children of many ethnicities are lined up to be greeted by Disney's newest princess and have their pictures taken.
Now come on over so I can get some big old hugs. Oh, thank you so much, sugars.
Disney store manager Barbara Williams gets a little emotional when she talks about it. Williams is proud of the Tiana launch as a Disney employee and as a black consumer. She says at the close of a black cultural festival recently, a man came by just as the festival was ending.
And he saw the Disney booth, and he turned and he said, "Tell Disney they did good."
With Tiana, Disney is banking goodwill and its more tangible byproduct. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
There's magic in the air.
That's really sweet. It's also doing enormously at the box office. It's only in a couple of theaters this past week, and it did hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's huge.
Tianapalooza.
Yeah, it's a great word. Okay, from Disney's world to something a little less bright, the new film The Road opens with a bit of natural beauty, a woman standing in a garden, flowers blooming, not realizing that it's the day before the end of the world. Then some sort of cataclysm strikes, they don't say what it is, and the rest of the film is its aftermath, viewed through the eyes of two survivors trudging along a road, a father and a son. The movie is based on the novel by Cormac McCarthy. NPR's Steve Inskeep spoke with the director John Hillcoat about the process of adapting that book to film.
At the heart of the story is a love story between a father and son. And I think that world just tests the characters, you know, brings out the best and the worst. But then the problem is that fear and caution can start to erode your own values in a way.
Because we're in this world where the plants have died, the animals have died, there is no sunshine. Some human beings are still alive, but many of them have turned into cannibals to survive. And the question is, how can this father and son survive without resorting to that awfulness?
That's right. That's why Cormac described it as a story of human goodness. It's how do they hang on to their humanity? How do they not slide into the base nature that we've seen? And this is what's great about the story, is that you can really understand this father is a good man, and you can see how under pressure his morals start to slide. And it's actually the boy that teaches him and reminds him of his own humanity and actually ironically saves him.
Let's play a little bit of The Road here. This is a scene in which the father, played by Viggo Mortensen, is confronting a member of a cannibal gang who is looking a little too hungrily at the son. And Mortensen has a gun with just two bullets left, which he's pointing at the man.
You look at him again, I'll shoot you in the head.
That boy looks hungry. Why don't y'all come on the truck? Get you something to eat.
You don't have anything to eat. Come on.
I ain't going nowhere.
You think I won't kill you? You're wrong.
You know what I think? You never killed a man in your life.
Which no doubt is true of that father, and the question is how far he's going to go to protect his son.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about trying to make those conflicts real, feel real.
Reality actually is what it was all about. You know, the image of the father pushing a shopping cart with all their possessions along a road with a grubby ski jacket, you know, that's the homeless in every big city. So for the wardrobe, we literally referenced hundreds of photographs of homeless people, and for the actual landscape, we looked at a combination of man-made and natural disasters that have already occurred.
Where did you find the apocalyptic scenes that you show here? The dead roads with cars strewn everywhere, dead cities, boats washed up on land, on and on.
Well, the boats washed up on land is actually IMAX footage shot 2 days after Katrina happened.
Around New Orleans?
Yeah. And we filmed in the there's still the aftermath of Katrina going on. And then in Pennsylvania, there were some abandoned interstate freeways. There was the leftovers of the strip mining and huge ash piles. And then we went to Mount St. Helens in Washington State. And that's still an unbelievable landscape. Yeah, it's jaw-dropping when you see these giant trees that have been ripped out of the ground. You know, and it was winter. We were looking for overcast days. Of course, we became very miserable when the sun came out. My brilliant Spanish cinematographer Javier would be screaming at the sky in Spanish.
Cursing the nice weather.
Yeah, and when it was miserable and raining sideways, we would all be in very high spirits.
That perfectly describes what this film is like. I mean, it's amazingly bleak. It's really grim. And, you know, I spent about half of it wondering, okay, I like this picture, but who is going to want to go see it? It's kind of we've seen some of this stuff before. Think the Terminator, which is all in the same kinds of battleship gray coloring. The whole palette of the film is like that. But that had people shooting at each other all the time. So there was something, at least there was some yellow in it because things were blowing up. This doesn't have that. And I thought, well, it's a much more artistic picture. It's a much more impressively made piece of filmmaking. But you do have to kind of wonder who's going to want to see something that bleak.
And you see this as kind of a trend. Is that right, Bob?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of pictures. I just saw A Single Man the other day, which is a beautiful picture, but it's about death and coming to terms with it. And it's beautifully made by Tom Ford, who is a fashion designer. So he made this exquisite looking thing. And I think you can make an argument for the notion that Precious surprises people. It's a really downbeat subject, right? And when you hear about it, you think, oh God, I don't want to see that. And yet audiences are really warming to it. So I think this is like a year of these beautifully made, really grim movies. It'll be interesting to see how they all pan out at the end of the year.
We'll go to another bleak place in our next piece. That is the Antarctic landscape. That's where musician Paul Miller, who's better known as DJ Spooky, went to record natural sound for a new composition. It's pretty far from his usual brand of dance music. NPR's Robert Smith asked DJ Spooky if Antarctica changed the way he listens.
Antarctica changes the way you think about everything. First, it's existential because there's very few people, if not no people. You go over a ridge, you get away from the rest of the crew. You see probably a million penguins or something, usually Adelie or Emperor penguins. Their sound actually is very loud, and they also smell terrible. Everyone thinks penguins are polite and pleasant, but they're just as noisy as being in the middle of a huge crowd.
They're like New Yorkers.
Yeah. So then getting away from that, yeah, the rest is wind, the occasional snap storm that would pop up, just incredible open expanses.
Well, we don't think too much about the sound of ice, except maybe cubes in a cocktail glass. You brought in your laptop. Why don't you play us some of the sounds that you heard in Antarctica?
Okay. This is a glacier. It's not the most exciting sound because you have to imagine its time frame is about a couple million years.
But you're not looking for excitement. You're looking for sort of raw material.
Yeah, raw material. So let me just play you a sound of a glacier, and I'm going to skip into it a little bit. So those small incidental sounds are the glacier kind of buckling and heaving, but very subtly. And if you stand still, you can hear the ice sort of slowly buckling, which means you could easily fall through it. And you don't necessarily want to be in a situation like that. So it's always just give it a little bit of respect and a little bit of space and continue to try and figure out where the actual solid land is that you're walking on.
You can hear the full interview as well as full songs of DJ Spooky's at npr.org/culturetopia.
Let's move on to Danielle Moinadine's new book of short stories, In Other Rooms, Other Wonders. It's something of a backstory for his home country, Pakistan. The book has been passed around amongst top officials in the Obama administration thanks to its depictions of Pakistan's social structure and feudal system. NPR's Steve Inskeep recently asked Moinadine whether anyone believes the system in Pakistan is fair or just.
No, nobody thinks that. In Pakistan, there's just such disparities in wealth. There are so many who don't have enough, and there are a few who have way too much.
Do people widely believe in Pakistan that if a poor person or a poor family works hard, works honestly, and plays by the rules, that they could someday get ahead?
No, they don't. One of the things I've observed in Pakistan is that because people for generations have been living just at the edge of true desperation, they're very, very averse to innovation. At my farm, for example, you'll see a guy who's, I'm exaggerating, but he's moving dirt from point A to point B, and he's carrying it in a little bucket. And I'd say, hey, why don't you, four of you get together and get a big platform, put all the dirt on that platform, and then pick it up and move it over to the other place, wherever you want to move it. And their reluctance to do it is puzzling and exasperating. And I think the reason is that innovation is dangerous. If you aspire, you can achieve, but you can also fail. And I think that failure is much more costly in a place like Pakistan than it is in, say, America.
You have no margin for error.
Exactly. If you do something new and it turns out to be a bad idea, you could fall very far.
Well, I wonder if some of this leads to the corruption that you describe. You describe when you tried to retake control of the family farm that the employees were basically stealing from the farm. I wonder if that's a natural reaction for people who feel that the system is unfair, that they have no stake in it, and that probably someone is stealing from them.
That's true. But also it's true that in Pakistan there's sort of a culture of corruption, which I'm sure there are people listening to your show, Pakistanis, who will attack me for that. But I think there is a culture of corruption. There's not a stigma attached to corruption, certainly not in the same way as there is in the West.
Well, we should point out that even though you're speaking critically of your country and you write critically of your country in some respects, you also make it clear in this book and Other Rooms, Other Wonders. I mean, you create wonderful characters. It seems plain to me that you came to like, appreciate, even love some of the people that you have known and worked with in the countryside of Pakistan.
I love Pakistan with all my heart. I mean, you can't write without being affectionate about a place or loving it, really. But I think that there's a saying, my country, right or wrong, is like saying, my mother, drunk or sober.
You'd rather she be sober, given
exactly.
A choice.
just because it's your country doesn't mean you can't criticize it.
I love that.
You could hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia. And the idea of drunken relatives can move us seamlessly into the next piece.
Totally. Food and drink always go together. And the piece, actually, is about the strong connection between food and music. So last week, with everyone gathering around the dinner table for Thanksgiving, eco-chef Bryant Terry put together a few suggestions for a musical menu, something to listen to while you're cooking the big feast and presumably having a nip at the same time. The songs accompany recipes in his cookbook, Vegan Soul Kitchen. Jennifer Ludden at Tell Me More asked Bryant Terry about his holiday playlist for a feature called In Your Ear.
Growing up, whenever food was around, music was around, my uncles crooning in the background or my mother playing the piano. So for the double maple coated pecans, I chose the song Hunter by Bjork. And just my memories of eating pecans involved me foraging at my grandfather's house because he had this gigantic pecan tree in his front yard. And so it just reminded me of just being this kind of like urban hunter. Next up is the sweet cornmeal coconut butter drop biscuits. For that particular recipe, I chose Turn Left for the soundtrack by a Swedish group, Little Dragon. You know, they're one of my favorite groups. When I was writing this book, their album had just come out, and I was listening to it just all day and with the lead singer Yukimi crooning over it. And so, you know, her voice is so syrupy and sweet and sultry. It just went perfectly with those sweet cornmeal coconut butter drop biscuits. Finally, the smothered seitan medallions and mixed mushroom gravy. The soundtrack for that is Brown by Roy Hargrove, the trumpeter. I often describe my cooking as jazz cooking because it's a lot of improvisation in there. You know, I like to start with the structure, the recipe, but so often I just go to the farmer's market, see what's available, and then, you know, just create from there. When you're making that shroom stock and you're cutting up those mushrooms and you're boiling that stock, Shroom Music by Quasimodo would be the perfect soundtrack. Look at here, it's the return again of the beat fixers, dropping like we on tape at its realistic mixes. A lot of the recipes were inspired by music. I mean, there are a number of recipes in here. I was listening to a song and actually literally an image for a recipe came up, but it's songs that might have inspired a recipe or a song that I might have been listening to when I was testing the recipe, or it might be a song that I felt would be the perfect accompaniment to that dish when you're eating it.
Music fans like me and probably you break out in big grins of recognition every time we watch the hit TV show Glee. The show's about a bunch of high school kids who sing top 40 songs in their Glee Club. 500,000 people have bought their version of Journey's anthem, Don't Stop Believin'.
Commentator Shana Naomi Crockmall says the art of the cover song is big business for music and for television.
Go ahead. Sing along to Journey. Everyone's doing it.
Just a small town girl, living in a lonely world. She took the midnight train going anywhere.
There's an easy built-in irony when a show choir full of outcast kids can bring such shameless enthusiasm to songs that may have once seemed all played out. There's also some basic economics at work. It's generally just cheaper to license the right to cover a song than it is to use the original recording. And that's especially appealing to TV shows working on a limited budget.
Dancing the Quick Step, Kelly Osbourne and her partner Louis Van Anstrom.
Still, that's no excuse for the lame lounge versions of songs on ABC's Dancing with the Stars. 99 rebels, floating in summer sky. Panic bells. No one is rushing out to buy that. So, how do you make a song shine like new? It has to transform the original without reeking of a karaoke knockoff. Take a cue from American Idol. It's a show created to discover the chart toppers of tomorrow by making them sing the hits of yesterday. When Adam Lambert sang Mad World on this year's Idol, it went back to Gary Jules' take from Donnie Darko, but also to the Tears for Fears original from 1982. Lambert's Mad World charted at number 19 on the Billboard Hot 100, far higher than either of his predecessors. This recycled approach is as old as the music industry. For decades, charts combined the sales of all versions, so the more singers who took on a song, the better the chance of having a number one hit. And films did it too. When Singing the Rain opened in 1952, there wasn't an original song in it.
I'm dancing and singing in the rain.
The movie was advertised as a vehicle for the songs you like, a blatant appeal for the same kind of hand-me-down nostalgia that's fueling the sales of Glee's albums today. Falling for the cover of a song you long ago wrote off can be a little embarrassing, but we're all hardwired to have a soft spot for the familiar. Just consider it an encore.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Bob Mondello.
And I'm Neda Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.
See ya.